ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Managers and employees alike can find performance reviews, well, hard work. So let's review the performance review. How would you rate them? 5, outstanding. 4, exceeds expectations. 3, meets expectations. 2, needs improvement. Or 1, unacceptable. Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. Whether you're giving one or having one, it can sometimes feel like the official performance review process is missing the mark. What would you change about performance reviews? Or maybe your organisation nails them. Please share. You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Or if you're listening live, text 0418 226 576. Michelle Brown is a Professor of Human Resource Management at the University of Melbourne. Hello, Michelle.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
David Berkus is a former business school professor turned consultant and a trained organisational psychologist. Hello, David.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
They've both researched and written chapters in books about performance management, so we're in good hands. David, what's the actual purpose of a performance review?
I would say purpose versus intent, right? The intent was noble. The intent was to give employees feedback, to make sure that every employee got actual feedback on their performance and how they could improve. But it also sort of turns into a classification system. Who are our high potentials? Who are our not, et cetera? And candidly, it happens so infrequently because it's so laborious that I'm not sure the feedback works all that well either.
Michelle, anything to add here about the purpose of a performance review?
Officially, the idea of a performance review was that it was a way of communicating organisational expectations to employees, so employees would know what the expectations of the organisation was. As David pointed out, there's a sort of a strong evaluative element to it, so you can identify the best performers and then reward them. But for employees, the most important part's often been the developmental aspect. What do I have to do to get a pay rise or a promotion within the organisation?
So it sounds like we have lots of purposes here, which could be confusing. Michelle.
Exactly. I mean, the argument is that the evaluative part is sort of in conflict with the development part, because the evaluation part is really around giving somebody a number on their performance, and that number can be used to adjust your pay or to give you a promotion. But the development part is around identifying weaknesses, things that you need to change. So why would you start talking about weaknesses if there's a chance that it could actually undermine the rating that you get?
Okay, we're going to delve more into this in just a moment. But Michelle, what do we know about how managers feel about this process?
Managers, I think, find it a really difficult process because they are also trying to get the most out of their employees. But at the same time, they have these ongoing relationships with people. So if you give someone a bad rating, they're likely to become passive aggressive, report in sick, not be very productive afterwards. It can kind of damage the relationship with the supervisor. So there's that kind of challenge. And so what you often see is that supervisors tend to inflate ratings in order to try and maintain the relationships with their employees. And then maybe a couple of other points I could make is that we know that the way managers do this can often be a function of the level of experience that they have. So somebody who is doing performance reviews for the first time often tends to follow the system kind of quite slavishly. But as people have more and more experience, they tend to interpret the system in a way that they think works for them.
That doesn't sound good, though.
No, because the idea is that you want managers to evaluate performance on the basis of the sort of specified criteria, not necessarily coming up with criteria that they think might be appropriate in the circumstances.
David, what's your take on how managers feel about performance reviews?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think a lot of the newer managers see it as what is this process? I'm spending hours and hours preparing for this process, and then I need to make sure that I follow it to the letter. And meanwhile, you have sort of the veterans that are kind of, I won't say making it up as they go, but they put their own spin on it, they're customizing it. And as a result, you get this huge ambiguity, right? And then you add in the subtle words you often get from leadership that not everybody can exceed expectations, right? There needs to be a clustering around the middle. And suddenly you're thinking, oh no, I actually have to make everybody conform to a bell curve to get this right. You're just adding additional work and additional stress on it. And I think that's why the most recent global survey I found was only about 25% of managers thought that their system actually improved performance versus just evaluating it.
And I know that some managers might actually, for difficult people, give them better ratings because they don't want to have the difficult conversation with the difficult person.
Yeah, I mean, we know that giving negative feedback to somebody is a very fraught process, and we've sort of got this inbuilt defense mechanism. Somebody says something negative about you, and your response is to defend yourself, and so managers can avoid that. We also know that they might inflate somebody's ratings so that they'll go and work somewhere else. So you don't have to deal with the problem.
Really?
You simply send it somewhere else.
All right, let's look at the employee's perspective then. Michelle, what about employees? How do they view performance reviews generally?
If you have a look at the survey evidence overall, employees say that they don't find it particularly useful. If you start sort of breaking that down by demographic groups, what you find is that younger people often say that they find the process useful because, you know, they're going to get feedback, which then they can then use to get a higher rating, get promoted, and get career development. So younger people are probably on average a little bit more interested. Older people say, I know how to do the job, just leave me alone. Just let me do the job. So overall, the pattern seems to be most people don't find it useful. But if you break it down by demographic characteristics, there does seem to be a bit of a pattern there.
We're talking about performance reviews and employees' perspective. I asked you for yours, and this texter writes, I work in health and the performance review is simply a yearly tick box exercise of no value to employees, and I haven't seen it used to manage underperforming employees. David.
She sounds like she's worked there a while based on Michelle's survey data, right? She may not be one of those younger employees who's still excited, but instead she's one that has seen it happen time and time again. And I agree. I mean, there's a big difference too between that annual review process that often just has to sort of get done. It gets done on an annual cycle, et cetera, and the process of putting somebody on an actual performance improvement plan where we're coming up with a way to get them to move up and meet expectations or to be worked out. That's sort of an entirely different process in large organizations. That's a different person inside of HR you're working with, et cetera. So I can totally understand where her frustration comes from. And again, it sounds like she's done it multiple times and she's exactly one of those ones that say, I know how to do the job. Just let me do the job.
David, do you have any data from the US on how employees rate performance reviews?
Yeah. So over here in the US where I am, only about a third of employees say that performance reviews are even fair and objective. Right. So already we've got a failing grade. We're only scoring in the 30s. And again, I think a lot of the reason for that is one, many of them see it as a tick the box activity. This is just something we have to do every cycle, et cetera. But the other is they don't actually see that review is capturing their wins throughout an entire year. There's a strong recency bias a lot of times when a manager fills that out. And in the end, they don't really feel like they've been rated failure. So they're not getting fair feedback either. So this isn't, not only is it not fair and objective, it's not actually a tool that's helping them, because for feedback to improve performance, feedback needs to be served relatively quickly after somebody actually did the job, did the project, et cetera. And annual reviews especially just don't do that.
David, you've actually been at the wrong end of a bad performance review yourself. Do you want to just share a little bit here? You're in safe hands.
Yes, yeah. Maybe this is the reason I went back to graduate school and studied org psych, but I was working in a sales role for an organization. And I had a wonderful manager for about 4.5 years. And he announced that he was quitting and going to another organization about 2 months before the performance review process was set to go. So who stepped in to make sure that all the boxes got ticked, right, was his boss. So now I have this meeting with my boss's boss, who I've probably spent 3 hours with the course of 3 or 4 years. And because he's got to fill it out, but he knows nothing about my performance, I'm coming there with my wins and what I think I'm doing well and what I think the performance is. And the only data he has is last year's sales numbers, right? And so everything just goes back to the numbers. If I'm trying to argue that I'm doing great in this category, oh yeah, but your numbers were right in the median range you made, but you didn't exceed quota that much. So it's hard to see how you exceed expectations in this area, right? Or I would go in and try and talk about a developmental opportunity and maybe even put a positive spin on it. And ask for some sort of resource or training or something like that and go, oh, okay, well, that probably explains why your numbers were so low. I'm like, wait a minute, I thought you said my numbers were average, right? But it just kept going back to the numbers because he had no actual performance of mine to observe. He just had to go on what he had, which I sympathize for him, I do. But why not just skip it? Why not just say, hey, we can't do it this year because no one's here to evaluate you?
All right, David. Well, I'm glad that it spurred you on to do great things in this area. So what we're going to do now is look at some alternatives and just see what we've got. So I asked you on LinkedIn what you thought about performance reviews, and Alex sent this voice memo.
Imagine an elite person in sports or a master chess player or someone performing on the stage getting performance feedback once a year. It sounds pretty crazy, right? Because to perform and feel at our very best, employees need immediate and unambiguous feedback. And this allows them to adjust and adapt to gain a higher level of performance. And this creates an upward spiral of performance in that individual, but also in the team and the organisation.
Michelle, let's pick up on Alex's point. These reviews are usually done once a year. What does the research say about how effective that is?
What the research shows is that managers don't think that these annual events are useful. There was a survey done about a year or so ago of Australian managers, and 67% of them said that they didn't want these annual reviews. The view is, as the caller suggested, that more frequent feedback would be more appropriate. Sort of the idea is that you give feedback in sort of smaller bites and therefore it becomes more digestible. Whereas if you give once a year negative feedback, you get that problem of people being defensive and not responding to the feedback. So the question then becomes, is the more frequent feedback ultimately more effective? And it seems like it's a very mixed bag because, for example, if you give feedback really regularly, people don't have enough time to actually digest the previous round of feedback before they're getting more. And there is also some suggestion that employees might see it more as sort of more as harassment rather than sort of bite-sized bits of feedback. So I think there's those issues. And then the other is in terms of the content of that feedback. If you're getting negative feedback once a week, it's unlikely to be effective. So there is an argument for more feedback, but I think it's really around what the appropriate cadence is and what the kind of content of that feedback is.
Sarah McCann-Bartlett, CEO of ARI, the Australian HR Institute, says when it does come to best practice in Australia, increasingly, she writes, organisations are taking more of a continuous improvement approach with frequent ongoing feedback and coaching by managers. These would often be supported by a cycle of more formal performance discussions, often 2 to 4 meetings a year. It sounds like, well, managers are in a bit of a hard place here because they do they do more and it's too much, they do too little and it's too little. Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the $64 billion question, is what is the appropriate level of feedback? And I think the sort of the answer probably is much more nuanced. And what might be useful for people in sales is quite different to maybe what you get in terms of research and development. Because the nature of research and development is it's sort of quite a long, drawn-out process. You don't come up with a cure for cancer every 6 months, for example.
David, a few years back, some of the largest companies in the US got rid of annual performance reviews. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, and probably leading the charge of that was the media company and software company Adobe. And they basically decided we're going to ditch the performance appraisal entirely. They did an internal study and found that 17 hours per employee was the cost for a manager's time to do these annual reviews. And they thought, how could we better spend that 17 hours? What if we broke it up and we taught them how to do this coaching thing? And this is what I like, is they didn't just, to Michelle's point, they didn't just say, oh, we need more frequent feedback. They said, here's a model you can use to do what they called check-ins. And a check-in was any conversation that hit on 3 areas. Expectations, what are the performance expectations? Feedback, how are you doing? But also, how am I doing in supporting you? And then growth and development. You know, what do you want from this? Where do you want to make your own career pivots, your own career growth? How are you feeling about your role and what might change, et cetera? Expectations, feedback, growth and development. And what I love about that, I mean, it was hugely successful there. It got modeled at a lot of different places, many, many first in software, but moving throughout. But what I love about that is I've worked with a lot of organizations more recently that haven't ditched the annual review entirely, But many managers and even the HR leaders inside are training managers on how to still have that check-in, how to still have that conversation on a regular basis. So when the annual ritual comes up, it's just another conversation. And no surprise, those are the ones that are actually seeing a lot more positive attitude towards these performance reviews than the ones that are still doing it the old way.
Any unintended consequences of this new approach?
So I suppose the biggest unintended consequence we're seeing is to Michelle's point, sometimes you're actually on a longer cycle than what you might be held accountable to for these check-ins. So you're getting feedback, you don't necessarily know what to do with it, et cetera. But I think the other thing to stress here is that that feedback often needs to be on specific aspects of performance. We saw this action and it would be better performed this way, et cetera, and not just super vague. So when we can get deep and we've built after multiple check-ins throughout the year, we can build enough trust to have a real conversation about what behaviors am I seeing, not just what results are you producing, then we can give people far, far better feedback to improve their performance than we can if we just wait to the end of the year and label them.
If this is so good, why hasn't it caught on then, David?
my really cynical answer is there are a lot of people who have a lot of paychecks invested in making sure that the annual ritual moves on. But I do actually, to me, as Michelle said it right at the top, there is a justifiable reason to let the organization know where employees sit inside of meeting the expectations. There is a value to communicating what those expectations are, what a good member of the organization looks like on a regular basis. So there is some value to the ritual. I just think it kind of needs to be supplemented by a much better tool to improve performance.
So I'm going to circle back to where we started, David, with the intention for performance reviews, the purpose. Are we trying to make performance reviews do too many things?
We're trying to make them do way too many things if they're a one-hour conversation once a year, for sure. I think a lot of times, one of the things we're also seeing in the United States is a split between the performance conversation and the annual raise conversation. And I think that speaks to your exact point, is saying, hey, this conversation was doing too much and we weren't having an honest conversation having the two of these things. So let's split them apart. So we are starting to see that unpacking, that these are different conversations. Maybe we ought to be having some more frequently, some less frequently, and definitely at different times from each other.
Michelle, should we be unpacking this, or is this now just going to add this burden on managers and all they're going to be doing is performance reviews all year and no actual work?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the theme that you get through the research, is that managers are being asked to do so much. They've got to reach sales targets. They've got to be able to deal with clients and customers, and that managing people is really just a very small part of their job. But I think the other thing, to sort of David's point, is that all of this requires very different skills of managers. So to be able to have a coaching conversation as opposed to an evaluative conversation requires a different set of skills. And some of the research that I've been doing says that people don't really feel comfortable having those conversations. They're really around being able to discuss performance in a very sort of nuanced way, to be able to think on their feet, to be able to problem solve, which is often quite a challenge for managers. But it's also for employees, because you need to understand what you do and what the options might be and how you might do things differently.
You're with Lisa Leong for This Week in Life, looking at the art and the science of performance reviews with the experts Michelle Brown, Professor of Human Resource Management at the University of Melbourne, and David Berkus, former business school professor turned consultant and a trained organisational psychologist. Coming up, you're going to get some tips and advice for managers conducting performance reviews. But first, I would love to hear from you. What would you change about performance reviews, or maybe your organisation nails them? Please share. You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. James says, my organisation is headquartered in Sydney and I'm based in Canberra. Our performance reviews are done via online forms, which did not support my Apple computer. I've never had the opportunity to respond. Thankfully, they've been good so far. This person texted, I have seen a performance development agreement as a tick box exercise and used to back training opportunities. The manager and culture are key. People should know how they are performing at work from regular specific feedback. So it sounds like we're getting on the same page here with what we want from performance reviews. Now, David, we've spoken a bit about ratings. What do you see happen in practice?
I see a lot of jockeying for position in these ratings, right? I've been in senior leadership meeting rooms as we've had these discussions, and there's a constant reminder the higher up you go inside an organization to managers at the lower levels that there should be a clustering around the middle, right? That not everybody gets to exceed expectations. Some people have to be in that meets. And what that produces inside an organization is subtle pressure on managers to make sure they're not overweighting people. And then that tension combined with what Michelle was speaking about earlier and the tension to go, well, I don't want to have this uncomfortable conversation. So now this person should be lower and they're clustering toward that middle as well. And that's not all that effective. One organization in the United States here at Microsoft actually was one of the other organizations that ditched performance reviews. And the reason they did it was that they saw that limiting the number of people who could be 5 out of 5 or 4 out of 5 was actually causing the most talented people to flee from each other and work on projects elsewhere in the organization. They were all worried about the fact that they would have to compete for that title. They would rather be on other teams where they could still be the star player. And that's a huge problem.
All right, David, let's go to managers now. In your experience, what's best practice for a manager doing a performance review?
Yeah, so there's a lot to be said for making sure you're nailing that coaching conversation, but that's like a whole other episode. For now, I would say the single best thing I think you can do to make sure you're having a good performance review annual conversation is to make sure that you're capturing people's wins and developmental opportunities as you see them throughout the year. I tell a lot of managers, create a subfolder in your inbox, and every time somebody does something great, drag an email about that into your folder. Every time you have to give them kind of a check-in conversation, drag that in. So you actually do have a year's record of what they did over the entire year. Otherwise, you're gonna show up about 2 weeks before you're supposed to do that scheduled meeting, and you're just going to go, oh gosh, what do I remember about
that? Is that up to the managers or up to the employees, David?
Well, I want to put the onus on the managers. I do feel for, as Michelle said, managers already have a ton. And I also would say that if your manager's not doing it as an employee, make sure you're doing it, because if they only have vague memories and you have data, you're going to get a better review than I think you would have if you showed up with vague memories too.
Michelle, what does the research show about best practice with performance reviews?
I think one of the things that managers need to remember is that they are also being evaluated when they conduct these evaluation meetings. I think it's often, they think it's a one-way conversation, the manager's telling the employees how they're doing. So I think it's partly important for managers to remember that the way they do it is actually important. But the trend seems to be to be moving away from kind of weakness or negative-based feedback. So, the original philosophy of performance management was that you would tell somebody what they've done wrong, they'd be mortified, and they wouldn't repeat that performance in the future. But we know from the positive psychology movement that you can't build people up by knocking them down. So the smart money seems to be saying it's more about identifying people's strengths and building on those as a way of improving employee performance, that when you give that weakness or sort of negative feedback, it just tends to make people defensive and there aren't any subsequent improvements in performance.
What in the scenario, though, where I get a meets expectations and I want to know how to get up to exceeds, and you're telling me all the good things that I've been doing, so surely I'm going to ask you, where am I going wrong?
I think it's around what you think the definition of strength-based feedback is. So your example is just positive feedback. Great job, Lisa. You've been a fantastic interviewer this year. Whereas strength-based feedback would say around what kind of strengths that you have. So it might be in terms of your communication skills, your problem-solving skills, your capacity to identify appropriate interviewees, that sort of stuff. So it's more around the kind of qualities that you have as opposed to sort of more just positive feedback.
We have a question from Christy.
How do you change performance management from being seen as a HR compliance exercise to one that truly adds value and meaningful conversations whilst driving a high performance culture and rewarding those that are truly high performing individuals?
David, do you want to have a crack at this one?
I would say it really depends on what you're doing leading up to that. If you have this regular cadence of having check-ins with your people, talking about where they're growing, what development opportunities they want, but also where they're really exceeding and performing, then this conversation shouldn't be a surprise to them. It should just be yet another conversation, and maybe even received as the conversation that grows beyond just you and me as one team and grows to senior leadership and through HR and what have you. If you're doing that, then they're not going to see it as a tick the box. They're going to see it as like, this is the time to actually get your good grades posted.
Michelle, any reaction?
I think sort of there's always been this argument that you want to recognise and reward the high performers. But for me, the kind of interesting question is, does it have an impact on other people? Because the argument would be that if this person really is good, you'd want to be able to showcase them so other people know what to do. Whereas it sounds like what the caller is looking to do is to have a sort of a singular plan for this person. So I think the sort of broader issue is, how do you make sure that the achievements of this person can also signal what other people are potentially able to achieve?
All right. So let's rate performance reviews before you both go. So, David, we're going to rate, let's say, 5 is exceeds and 1 is unsatisfactory. How would you rate performance reviews?
I would say on the whole, they're probably a 2, needs improvement, but in a lot of organizations, they are unsatisfactory.
Michelle?
I'd concur with that. When you look at the sorts of attitudes that managers and employees report around performance management, it's clearly not doing very well. And I suppose the other point that I would add is if you want a performance management system to be equitable, women actually tend to do worse in these performance management systems than men.
Thanks so much to you both. Michelle Brown is a professor in human resource management at Melbourne University, and David Berkus is a former business school professor turned consultant. And managers, we have a whole episode planned about giving and receiving feedback, so watch this space. And employees, we haven't forgotten about you either. There's a bonus episode coming your way on how to nail your performance review. Search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app and tap the heart to follow us. Then you'll get it delivered straight to your phone. And last word goes to This Working Life for Mark, who works in performance management technology and who responded to my call out on LinkedIn with his top 3 things he would change about performance reviews.
First, I see is many organizations wanting performance reviews to do way too much. So start by asking, what is the purpose of our performance reviews? And limit it to one thing. Tie it to a business objective, and that is the purpose. Secondly, I would simplify the process. They are nearly always too complicated. They need to be uncomfortably basic. They should be done in less than 30 minutes per person as a rule of thumb. Finally, looking at what problem are we looking to solve, getting employee input on that initial design for what the process looks like. Start small, then iterate the process with feedback from employees, and above all, make it useful to employees and managers. Applying a principle of making this a minimum effort, maximum impact process, rather than coming from the perspective of trying to create the perfect HR best practices.
Thanks, Mark. Now it's time for Try This. Welcome to Try This. On our last episode, we learned about purpose at work and the different ways people are finding it, and we asked you to share your stories. We got this email from Delith. I'm so lucky to work for a firm that has a very well-respected pro bono program and chief community officer who supported my idea to bring an exceptional group of women in STEM together with not-for-profits who are looking for STEM skills on their boards. According to the AICD, only 3% of Australian directors have any STEM skills. It's been so wonderful and a huge privilege to bring this idea to life. Thanks, Delith. And Peter loved the interview with Mick Lubinskas, and Peter shares, I had my own midlife crisis. After working in finance as an accountant for 20 years, I decided to follow my passion for education and do a dip ed in secondary school teaching. But I had a young family at the time and decided I couldn't support my family well enough on a teacher's salary. Although I'm still working in finance 15 years on, I've managed over the years to incorporate teaching into parts of my role. I'm also looking into full-time education roles now that my kids are at uni, possibly teaching financial literacy and superannuation to adults. I work for a super fund. Thanks so much, Peter. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Matthew Sigley. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. And meet me here again next Friday, live from 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app. Tap the heart to follow all of our stories. And we'll put up another question on LinkedIn next week for you to ponder. Until then, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.